Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. I said last week we're going to start the book of Joel, but as I was preparing for it, I began to realize we've got some background, and we're not specifically sure in the book of Joel where the book begins. I'm going to open up and look at the beginning of the book of Joel. This does not mean we're going to be in Joel tonight, nor does it mean we're going to be in Joel next week, but we're heading towards Joel. Some would say, and again, this isn't when we start teaching Joel, we will not know when Joel was written. There's no way you can tell. There's some clues to kind of lean you one way or the other, and even and again, that's something I want. It's important to me, especially the way I interpret the Bible, the way I teach the Bible, the way I see the Bible. But if you separate it from the historical context, you can still read the book of Joel and gain insight from it. But now for me, it's just hard because you're not talking to a specific time period. I think it's similar to archaeology or geography. Reading the Bible without knowing the geography or the lay of the land is similar to playing chess without having the pieces on a chessboard. And same thing for me is making interpretation from the book. What are they saying? If we don't know who it's written to, and we do know it's the people of Judah in Jerusalem, but what people? Is it during the days of Isaiah and Hezekiah? Is it during the days of Jeremiah? Is it during the time of the return? Is it after, later on, after they've established themselves? When is it? It's going to help you determine, like for example, the book of Jeremiah, his generation was going into captivity. The generation of Isaiah, they were going to repent and recover, and the Assyrians would be driven out. Ezra's, Daniel's generation, they're returning. So that kind of helps determine how you need to know who is reading the letter, or in this case, the prophecy, for me and for general hermeneutics. But yet you can gain from it. Now, the two options, general options, and we'll talk more about this when we introduce the book of Joel, is written in the 800s. It's written during the days of Israel, while they were still there before they had fallen, or even during the days of Hezekiah, Isaiah, during that time period. So anywhere between 830 to 700 BC is a time frame people place it in. And when we're and again, that's open. I'm going to say I disagree with that. But it's because I want to take a position. When I read this, I want to be talking to a particular group of people. But at the same time, I've got to make sure my mind is open that this could be talking to someone that maybe 300 years earlier than the time that I'm applying it. Again, that's just the way I'm going to do it. There is the option that it's to the people. It's pretty clear. It's not written during the days of Jeremiah and Ezekiel during the fall of Jerusalem. And there's three major falls of Jerusalem or captivities. I've got them listed here. 605, the first captivity. 597, that's when Ezekiel was taken captive. And that's actually when Nebuchadnezzar entered the city. And he's got right here, I've got a picture of a cuneiform tablet in the British Museum of Nebuchadnezzar actually recording the 597 capture of Jerusalem. He considers 597 the year he captured Jerusalem. And he did. He took the king with Ezekiel, Jehoiachin. He took him captive and he was in charge of Jerusalem. So actually, Nebuchadnezzar took control of Jerusalem. He had it, he was able to enter it in 605, but it was his city and he set up his own king in 597, Zedekiah. But then they rebelled, and in 586, he's had enough of it, and he just burns it to the ground. So we consider 586 the fall of Jerusalem when it was burnt, but Nebuchadnezzar took control of it in 597, according to the Bible, and according to this cuneiform tablet. I mean, he says the same thing. It's his city. Then Ezekiel was prophesying during that time. I don't think that was when Jeremiah or Joel was written. You see the previous prophets talking about they usually, remember Amos, they would give the name of the king during the days of Uzziah. Or Jeremiah, he lists during the days of Josiah. Isaiah lists the kings. So they were kind of putting that in. It's possible that those were headings added on to the book by this group of people here, Ezra, the scribes, when they came back. Ezra, I've got his name written right here because he pops up in right around 520, 521. And these are important dates also because these dates, 605, 597, 586, that's the fall of Jerusalem, the three captivities. Then 539 is a big date because that's when Babylon falls to Persia. You can see over here I've got the blue, that's Babylon. Then the red, Cyrus began to reign over Persia in 559, and he had about a 20-year period of interacting with the kings of Babylon, making treaties with them. But finally in 539, he's just conquering them, along with Darius the Mede. And in 539, on October 12th, 539, that's Belshazzar's party on October 12th. October 29th, that's when Cyrus enters. So Darius is there on October 12th. Cyrus arrives. His military was there taking the city. He arrives later that month. And so Cyrus now is the emperor. Darius is the king in Babylon under Cyrus the emperor. And they were working together. Darius was the Mede. Cyrus was the Persian. And then he's going to reign until 530 and is killed in battle. The important date there is 539. And that is when he sends the people back, and that's when you're going to have Ezra's going to take the people back. So Ezra's recorded here. Ezra's got some recordings here, and Ezra's got some recordings here. And so that the book of Ezra is going to cover that time period. After 539, the important date is 520. When they get over here, they set the altar. They set right here. By 536, the altar is built. So Cyrus takes control in 539. 538, they're getting their things ready to go. In 537, the Jews are back in Jerusalem. And, you know, the process of getting everybody there. Now, not every Jew came back from captivity. Just some Jews were born in captivity. They were born in Babylon, and they stayed. And you could be critical of them, but they just didn't have the religious fervor to go back. It'd be like us going back to our homelands. It's like, well, what is your homeland? You know, is it England? Is it Germany? Is it Africa? Is it South America? What's your homeland? The Jews, I mean, I don't want to go back to, I guess I'm from England. I always thought I was from Germany. Did the ancestor test and looked at some more genealogy records. And I'm more English than I am German. So I've got the Weimer's last name for German, but I'm more English. But I don't want to go live in England. I like visiting. I don't want to go back to Germany, although it'd be fun to go visit. I'm an American. Well, that's what some of these people were. In 539, you're free to go back and rebuild your country. Now, if you had a vision for the promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you're going to rebuild the temple, and it was instilled in you, you were going to go back, and you would be a patriot. You would be a believer. You would be a conservative Jew. But many of the Jews, it's like, business is good in Babylon. Thus, you're going to have people like Esther who are going to be staying there, and her uncle. They're staying there. And many just stayed there. Nehemiah, you know, you're going to get critical. Here's Nehemiah and his family. He's the wine bearer of Artaxerxes. That's the wine bowl. There's like a set of wine bowls, and I've told you this before, in the British Museum, just set up in a case. I can't remember if there's three or four of them. And they say right on there, Artaxerxes, the great king of Persia, in cuneiform writing. And Nehemiah, according to scripture, was the wine bearer. And he talked to Artaxerxes. He brought him the wine, and they had a conversation. Even Artaxerxes commenting, "You look sad." I mean, so they had some. I mean, if you just see me passing by in Hy-Vee, you don't say, "Boy, you look sad today, Galen." You don't even know who I am. But if you know somebody, so Artaxerxes knew Nehemiah well enough that he commented on his appearance. And Nehemiah was scared because, you know, we'll talk about that when we get there. But, you know, the king is commenting, you should be happy when you're in my presence and you look like something's wrong. And then Nehemiah says, well, I'm just going to go for it, you know, and tells him, how can I be happy? My city's in ruins. There's no wall. I mean, they're being overrun. And Artaxerxes said that. Now, again, that's going to be 450, 446, 445. So count the years. They go back in 439. In 445, there's still no wall, and the city is still in rubble. And Nehemiah is like, he wants to see that he just had his brother come back from Jerusalem. So there's some kind of trade, travel back and forth. His brother comes back. He goes, well, how's the city going? How's it going? I mean, he's maybe financially supporting it, maybe praying for it, but he's got a job. He can't go back. And his brother says, oh, it's not good. So that's really bummed Nehemiah. He thought they were kind of making progress. And so Nehemiah ends up saying, well, here's what we need to do. And Artaxerxes says, well, why don't you do it? I'll fund it. So Nehemiah wasn't just a servant carrying a cup of wine around. He had some kind of training, leadership skills. And I don't think they're just grabbing Nehemiah out of a bunch of nobodies. I mean, he was somebody with some kind of education, some kind of training, that Nehemiah gives him permission to return to Jerusalem to build the walls. There's the remains of some of the walls that have been excavated that were built by Nehemiah and his people. Nehemiah begins building the walls on October 10th. The walls are done on October 2nd in the year 443. And by October 8th, Ezra's reading the wall. And then, that'd be 445. That's 445. In 433, Nehemiah's 12-year period of being sent over, employed by Artaxerxes. But Artaxerxes gave him a leave of absence for 12 years. Well, go fix it. I'll give you 12 years. Be back by, this certain date. And so in 433, in Nehemiah chapter 5, 14, 13, 6, it's like, I got to go. I got to get back to Artaxerxes. And so he returns back to his services in the Babylonian palace after being 12 years in Jerusalem. So my point, 539 is an important date. They come back. They're excited. They build the altar, offer a sacrifice on the Temple Mount. We assume it's Mount Moriah. And they go into a stall. They're busy. They got things going on. And during this entire time here, that's all they've got. There's no house, no temple. They have houses they're building. But it wasn't until 520 when Haggai and Zechariah began to prophesy in 520. And these prophecies are dated. These prophecies by Jeremiah and some of these prophets are prophets before Jeremiah, they list the king. They say this is the king that they served under. It would have been during this time, Ezra's time right here, when we're kind of closing down the New Testament, getting everything together, that they're looking back and going, well, let's put a, again, this isn't for sure, but it's probably not, Jeremiah, who's, when you got a collection of his prophecies, he's probably not the one that wrote, Jeremiah, the son of so-and-so, prophesied during the reigns of, and lists all the kings, because he couldn't have done that, because some of the prophecies were taking place before some of these kings were in office. He maybe came back and put it all together, or more likely, his students or the people that collected it collected his writings, and then at some point, someone went through, possibly someone like Ezra, during this period when they're putting everything, collecting their scriptures, and they dated them by saying during these person's reigns, during the 2 years before the earthquake, and these are things they're writing in there. When we look at Joel, if you got your book open in Joel, we'll mention it here real quick, chapter 1, verse 1, the word of the Lord that came to Joel, son of Pethuel. Now, there's several things in the book that indicate a later date. Now, like I said before, there's a lot of references in Joel coming from Jeremiah, Isaiah, and other prophets that give the impression if Joel was written in the past, he's one of the first prophets to write, like during the days of Hosea. Because you've got prophets like Elijah, Elisha. Where's their writings? You've got a letter recorded by Elijah that was read after he died, but where's his writings? You've maybe got his pronouncements, but you don't have his book. Hosea was one of the first prophets to actually write down his prophecy. Joel would have been one of those first prophets to write down his prophecy. And so that would mean the prophets like Jeremiah, Isaiah had read that, and they build on Joel's references. But you can also take and flip-flop it that Joel's on this side, that during this day when all this stuff is being compiled and they're dating it, this is when it was written, Joel is being written, and they didn't, again, this is an assumption, this is a speculation. They didn't put anybody's king's name on this because everybody knew Joel, because Joel just, he's Joel, he's common, he's current. The problem with that is Joel is right up there by Hosea, and even in the Jewish scriptures, he's up there at the beginning if there's any kind of chronological order, and sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. Joel's not back in the back by Malachi. He's up there by Hosea. So that would push him on this side. The fact that he's not identified except who's his father, that everyone would have known when Joel prophesied. Other things that you see in here, there's no reference to Israel in the north. If there is a reference to Israel, it's talking about Judah and Jerusalem. So we're not worried about the northern tribes. They're already gone, apparently, or there's no conflict, or they're not mentioned. Another thing, there's no reference to kings. There's reference to the elders, which is exactly what you have here. When they come back, the guy coming back, Zerubbabel, where's Zerubbabel? He came back, but, he's down here during this time period. I'm trying to say I got his name up here. But during this time period, Zerubbabel is active, and he's a descendant of Jehoiachin, the king, that was taken captive. After Nebuchadnezzar kept Jehoiachin in prison. Not necessarily chained to a wall, but in captivity. After he dies, Marduk, also known as Evil Marduk, and it has nothing to do with evil in the English language, it's E-V-I-L, or Amel Marduk, set him free. In fact, brought him in and made him a guest of a royal guest. He's a royal king from Judea. He brought him in and let him eat from the king's table. In fact, cuneiform, I should get a picture of it, cuneiform tablets from Babylon, from this time period, record Amel Marduk, or Evil Marduk. They have the rations for the family of Jehoiachin written in cuneiform on a tablet. His name is there, and here's what he gets. This is his provisions. It's a lot. It's figured into the national budget. This goes to Jehoiachin. And so Jehoiachin was in Babylon, according to the Babylonian records. He was treated as royalty, living in a palace, living in some kind of condition, really had no power except he was a captive king that was well treated. Anyway, that's another whole story. Some say Amel Marduk had himself ended up in prison and gotten released. He was taken exiled and then brought out of exile. So he had compassion for a king that was in exile, brought him out. Some say that had, but we don't know. But then Jehoiachin had a family, had wives, had children. They had wives, they had children, and that's where Zerubbabel comes from, who's going to be in charge of these things. So I'm looking here, and just we'll read about him when we get into those books there, and he helps build the temple. So he was a royal descendant. Nonetheless, I'm trying to give you the dates. 539, Persia takes over. 536, the altar is built, and then they go into a stall in Jerusalem, just kind of living their lives, dealing with typical situations. It wasn't a great city. It was a very, very rural city, very minimal, and they lived their lives. Haggai and Zechariah both begin to prophesy in 520. By this time, the prophecies, they are dating their prophecies. Ezekiel began to date his prophecies. We've actually got like the date. I've got 593 to 571 for the dates. The reason we know that is Ezekiel wrote the date of the prophecy. And his last prophecy was in 571. If we want to go through and look for, I could figure it out. It will tell you it's July 29th, 571. And he uses his dating system. But Ezekiel dates his prophecies. Daniel dates his prophecy. Remember, that's why we know it's during, well, here it is, in 553, 551, 539, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Daniel 5. Daniel was in the lion's den in 538, 536. That's when Daniel received Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12, because he's telling it was during the second year of Darius in Babylon. Or coming down here, it was during Belshazzar, 570. It was during that reign, that time period. So we know these things because he's telling you who was the king that he was writing under. So their prophecies either are dated by who the king was in the older days. These guys start dating it. Haggai and Zechariah, they give you the day, the year, the month of their prophecies. Ezra is crazy recorder. He's a scholar keeping all these things in track. Malachi doesn't have a date. And I put Joel, you can hardly see it right here. I've got Joel right here. That's temporary. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced. But I'm putting Joel back here because he doesn't match any of these dates, any of these systems of dating. He's just hanging there. Means they, assuming they would have known him, or they don't know when he prophesied. Maybe no one knows when he prophesied. Maybe it's not important. But there is no kings mentioned. There is only elders, leaders, and that's what you have right here. These people had, they had a priesthood reestablished, and they had elder rule. They did not have a king. Zerubbabel would have been the king. Coming out of Jehoiachin, Zerubbabel would have been a king, but he was sent back to be the governor of Judah under Persian rule. Now, he was royalty. He was from the lineage of David, but he did not take up the title king. It would have been a sign of rebellion being the king of Judah because it was a province of Persia. He was just the governor. So there were no kings, and so there's no kings mentioned in this. When they start criticizing people, they're going to talk to the elders or the leadership, but no kings. Again, these are not absolutes, but it pushes me to put Joel down here towards this side. It is a warning that's given. They're warning them. They've had a lot of trouble. The locusts have come in. There's been a famine. They're out of food. They're struggling. And basically the message is, anytime you're struggling like this, you better check yourself. Something's wrong. God brought you back from captivity. He doesn't say that in the text. But God brought you back from captivity not to have everything eaten by the locusts. But if everything's getting eaten by the locusts, you maybe want to consider what's wrong. What are you doing wrong? Consider your ways. And then this brings into that chapter a current problem, calling the people back to repentance. And another thing that takes place, everyone is supposed to gather. Everyone is called to gather and have a national assembly of repentance. Now, if you can imagine going back to 800, 700, that taking place, they did have Passover. Hezekiah tried to get a Passover organized, but it was a bigger monumental event, of it more than just everybody come to the temple. So it gives the impression that it's a smaller group. And listen, these things I'm saying, you'll have to hear it as we study and say, I disagree, I don't disagree, or whatever. There's a smaller group of people that could have gathered together. I just mentioned it. They could gather in Jerusalem, in Judea, at the temple. In 539, they come back from captivity. 536, they set up the altar. By 520, nothing has been happening. And two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, arise and basically start telling the people, what are you doing? It's time to get this temple built. You've been here since 39, let's say 38. Now it's 520, so you've had, 18 years to get this done? And they go, it's just not time. It's just not time. And they go, yeah, it's time. So Joel can't be written during this time. There's no temple. And then they get fired up. Amazingly, the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, not every prophet was a failure. Haggai and Zechariah motivated the people, and the temple is built by 516. Ezra 6:13 through 18, the temple has been rebuilt. It records it in Ezra right there. And they have the temple, and they start the services, and they're up and running. So now Joel could be written sometime after 516. Now, when is this going to take place? When is the country in a position where they're in rebellion, or they've got slack in their dedication to God, and they're being invaded by locusts, and they have to have a prophet tell them, hey, wake up. He does say things like, you need to remember this because nothing like this has happened to your forefathers. Now, when you say, it's going to be in there, you should wake up. This is not normally, did this happen to your father? Did this happen to your grandfather? Did this happen to your great-grandfather? We've never seen something like this where everything's being devoured by the locusts. It's like, well, now you can put that in perspective. How far back is he? Is it never happened to our forefathers? Well, you've had disasters throughout biblical history. And we're looking right here at 605 to 586, the total destruction of Jerusalem. So was it before this, and they've never seen anything like it? Or had that already happened, they've gone to captivity, they've come back out of captivity, they've built the temple, and things are clicking along, and all of a sudden, they're going off the edge. And he says, your forefathers, he's not talking about going all the way back to, you know, Isaiah, David, back to Abraham. He's talking about their current history. You've never seen this. Again, you'll have to make a decision. And so it's possible that Joel woke the people up, just like Haggai and Zechariah, because we don't see any deterioration. If you put it right here, I've got it right around 536, 539, right in this time period, 556. This is right about the time Alexander is born and the Greeks are moving. Now, when Babylon moved, when the Assyrians moved, they came and challenged Jerusalem, and they were disobedient, and they had trouble. They lost all their fortified cities. The Assyrians took every fortified city but Jerusalem, and that was spared because of Isaiah and Hezekiah interceding, and the angel of the Lord came. When the Babylonians rose, they showed up in 605, took captives. They showed up in 597, took the city, showed up in 586, burnt the city. The Persians now have gone through, and they've treated Israel well during this whole time period. Persia was not an empire that came and destroyed. They actually funded the return. We'll read in Ezra. They actually went into the Babylonian treasures and says, well, these are marked Judean temple, and gave back the goblets. Here's your bowls. Here's some stuff for your sacrificial system. And they brought back the articles for the temple from Solomon's temple. So the new temple actually had artifacts, utensils from the temple of Solomon. That's what Belshazzar was drinking out of. So they were sent back. When it comes time for Nehemiah, for an example, Nehemiah talks to Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes says, well, here, I'll give you a ticket right here. And he had something written up, says, here's documentation that you can have any of the trees from the king's forest. Well, where's the king's forest? Well, the king's forest is the land of Lebanon, the cedars of Lebanon. And it's really not the Persians' forest, it's just the Persians have conquered it, and now it's the king's forest. So it's like, I conquer this, you can have some of those trees. Are they your trees? Everything's mine. I conquered it, I took it. And so he gives them permission. So all Nehemiah's got to do to build the walls, or when they go back to build the temple, Zerubbabel, is they have documentation. The Persians are financing the building, restructuring, rebuilding of the temple and the city and the culture of the Jews. So that's a very positive thing. It's interesting, possibly with Joel, that as Persia is in decline, I've got Greece is rising here, Persia's still coming over. They don't fall until 331 is when Alexander sends Darius. Yes. I can. That was one of my struggles with this, where I'm going to put all this. Philip is king of Macedonia, and Alexander is born in 556. Macedonia takes Greece, so now they've united Macedonia and Greece. The Persians are still in charge, but the Persians have already come across, just like Daniel prophesied. Xerxes and Artaxerxes have come across and made war with the Greeks. They've crossed over the Aegean Sea and have gone in to make war. There's several wars we can talk about. If you ever saw the movie 300, that's one of these battles of these kings. Anyway, we'll talk about that. So they've already stirred up, just like Daniel says, the king will stir up Greece. And now Greece is rising, and they've organized Greece and Macedonia, and Philip is making plans to cross over the Aegean Sea and invade Persia. They're tired of Persian oppression. And so they're making plans. Well, not everyone agrees with it, and they assassinate Philip at his daughter's wedding, I think it was, in 336, leaving his young son, who was born in 356, 56, 46, 46, 36, so he's 23 years old, is that right? 23 years old, and he's king of Macedonia and Greece. And he says, now that's the young king that's coming out of Daniel, he leaves Greece, and he by 332, he's taken Egypt, Phoenicia, and Gaza, and has the last king, Darius III, on the run. By 331, He has taken Babylon and Persepolis, and Darius III is assassinated, and Greece now rules the entire Persian Empire, which is Turkey today, it's Israel, it's Phoenicia, it goes up into Egypt. He's taken Egypt already, and he just kept marching. He just keeps marching east until he runs out of steam, and he never makes it back. He dies in Babylon, Alexander, and that he dies in 323. My point there, which is mere speculation, is Joel may have been warning of the locusts, because they were there saying, this is you're in danger, and they're being overrun. And it is totally God's responsibility that the land is being overrun by locusts, and God is allowing it to happen because the people are disobedient. The second chapter of Joel goes in and starts talking about, just like we just got done with, what did we just get done with? Habakkuk. Starts talking about the day of the Lord, the great. Habakkuk is talking about the fear of Babylon coming, but he projects it into the day of the Lord. Joel's talking about locusts coming, and it's speaking of something worse that could happen, and that is the day of the Lord. And then we have a bunch of eschatological verses there in chapter 2 and 3 of Joel. We get a lot of stuff out of chapter 2 and 3 eschatologically. It could have been, in a sense, preparing the people for the coming of Alexander. When he came, he could have come like Nebuchadnezzar. He could have come like Sennacherib and burnt the city to the ground if they'd been disobedient. But when Alexander shows up in Jerusalem, the priests lead the people out, lead the priests out, and they show Daniel the book of Daniel. Excuse me. They show Alexander the Great the book of Daniel. Alexander, according to the story, gets off of his horse and recognizes the priest, goes in to the city and worships in the court of the Gentiles in the Jewish temple. He worships in the Jerusalem temple like all Gentiles could. He doesn't violate the temple. He doesn't march in like Pompey did to see what's behind the curtain. He just goes into the Gentile courts, offers his sacrifices like he did in many of the nations. He just let them keep their religion, let them keep everything. He just wanted to be their king and keep conquering. And so instead of burning the city, Alexander recognizes their religion, recognizes their priesthood, takes some of their people and puts them in places of position and leadership, and just keeps moving. So Joel, speculation, may have been preparing the people, warning, you've got locust problem, but if you don't fix this, you're going to have a bigger problem. Just like Jeremiah was saying, you've got problems, you've got a famine problem, and they did have, but if you don't straighten up, you're going to have a bigger problem. And if you don't straighten up, you're not just going to have Nebuchadnezzar controlling your city, he's going to burn it to the ground. And they never listen. These people may have responded to Joel and avoided Alexander's wrath, because the Samaritans just north of Jerusalem wouldn't cooperate. And Alexander just slaughtered the Samaritans. I mean, in Jerusalem, he's worshiping in their temple. The Samaritans also have a temple just a few miles to the north. But they get slaughtered by Alexander, and the Jews are like, what a great idea. I mean, the Jews are all like, do it, because they didn't like the Samaritans. But the Samaritans decided to fight Alexander, and they got destroyed. The Philistines, or Gaza, wiped out. Not Philistines, they're already destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. The Phoenicians wiped out. We could study about Tyre. The city of Tyre was wiped out. That's another great story. Ezekiel records that prophetically. So Alexander was more than capable of burning. He burnt Persepolis to the ground. Once they got to Persepolis, he just lets his men just have one wild night of partying. And they just, you talk about riots in, you know, Seattle or something, Minneapolis. He just says, you know, here's the alcohol, here's the fire, there's the women. Tear it down. And he did that to get revenge for what the Grecian or the Phoenician Persian kings did to Athens. They come over and burnt that city. He said, I'm going to burn one of their capital cities. And he did that. And he kind of wished he didn't, because it was a great city. All that's left is ruins of Persepolis. Anyway, that's the introduction to what we're looking at here. So I'm going to put Joel right about here. And as we read it and study it, we're going to have to think, where does it go? The message will be the same. It's just, who is he speaking to? Is he speaking to people of Hosea's day, Isaiah's day, Jeremiah's day? I don't think he's speaking to these people in here. I don't think he's speaking. He can't be too close to the destruction of Jerusalem, because everybody would remember that. He's got to be far enough away from the destruction of Jerusalem that he can say something like, we've never seen anything. Ask your forefathers, have they ever seen something like this? Well, if you're living here in 530, if you're living in this time, there are people coming back. In fact, when they finalize the, you know these verses, in 516, when they finalize the temple, it's like, oh, we did it. People began to cry. Some were weeping because we did it. Some were weeping because this is it. This is not, we didn't rebuild anything. You should have saw Solomon's temple. Because they had been there, they saw it burn, they were taken captive, and they returned to rebuild, and everybody's clapping, you know, this is the great, we've never done, there's never anything greater than this. It's like, yeah, there was. When I was a kid, this thing was the wonder of the world. And so they are crying for two things, two reasons. So at this time, they could remember. Your forefathers have never heard of anything like this. It's like, yeah, we have. We watched it burn. So you've got to get far enough away from this that they can say things. And it can't be this time because this is a pretty intense time where you've got Ezra. And you, when we get to read about Ezra, I mean, he's doing all kinds of crazy stuff and getting the people purified, including going to the priests who have married Samaritan women and they've got families. And this, I mean, wrap this around your head. It's like, this is an illegal marriage. You've got children with a woman who is not Jewish. Send her away and send their kids away. We're not going down this road. It's like, I mean, try that on for size. And they did. They did. They're trying to purify their nation. And so it's hard to imagine Joel talking that you need to repent. Because, I mean, these people were like, I mean, it was like, I mean, when I hear about Ezra, I think of John Calvin, you know, just that kind of that fiery, I'm going to be the government, I'm going to be the jury, and I'm going to use scripture to determine the speed limit. And so I think Joel, it kind of justifies it going this way. Now, again, I'll say again, that's not, we don't know, there's nothing there to give us that date. Now, any questions or thoughts about that? Yes, ma'am. That he would be like during the days of Hosea or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. That is one of the best suggestions. Yes. Right. No, exactly. See, that's what I mean. This doesn't need to become argument, once saved, always saved. You know, it's like, it's one of those things that's kind of like, okay, class, you were going to have a debate. You know, are you for, what was the kids having a debate? Oh, the kids were having a debate in school the other day about should teenagers get paid the same as an adult for the same type of a job? And then they of course, once you give them sides, they just become violent in their arguments, you know, because they're going to win their, you know, it's like a basketball game. And so anyway, that's more like what is kind of like, okay, because I do not know. I cannot at the end say I'm right. We're going to be able to read this and then be able to make some suggestions. It's kind of, but I think it's important because, and you know, a good scholar would be able to say, here's what this verse says. If it's being said in 850 BC, this would be the culture it would be in. Here's maybe some insight. But if it's back here, this would be some of the insight there. What my thought is, you know, there's no kings. There is a temple. The people can gather together quickly, assemble. You should go repent. Well, I mean, the whole nation, if you go back, Hezekiah's day, they'd already gone up into Israel. I mean, it's a major deal. The other thing, besides the fact that there's no kings and there's no mention of it, is Joel is not so much because he's got some highly developed theology, especially the day of the Lord, and he starts talking about the Spirit. You don't hear a lot of how Isaiah maybe mentions a little bit, but it's kind of like abstract. You almost got to read into it. But Joel is talking about the Spirit. And the Spirit was introduced in Zechariah. and Haggai, that, I mean, where the Spirit is really being talked about, the Spirit. And then you're going to have, you know, like in chapter 2, verse 28, the great verse from the day of Pentecost. And afterwards, I will pour out my Spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. And there's a variety of things in there, you know, that you're familiar with. So he's got a very highly developed eschatology, very clearly knows what the day of the Lord is. And now what I would say makes reference, draws from Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, all Ezekiel, all these prophets. And he, it's not like they're drawing from, it's not like Joel wrote, again, not like Joel wrote in 850 and everybody goes, oh, wow, what a great book. And they're trying to use his terminology. It's like he's over here and all the, he's got all the scriptures and he's just using reference and tying them together in a nice package. It's like, wow, how highly developed. So you can argue either way. I just, in my, because I had, when I started going through the minor prophets, I had it right away. The first book you teach is Joel and Hosea, or Hosea and then Joel, because that's the order. But as I began to look at it, it's like, I got to stick Joel in right after Hosea. I don't know how it fits. Because, I mean, then you notice all the prophets, I've been able to say, we had little charts, they all kind of march together, and it just keeps falling. Well, now here's Joel, and I just felt it was sloppy to put Joel there because I had no reference. I just have to, like, make stuff up. And so now, having gone through the prophets, I'm going to put it here, but we've had enough discussion that's like, wait, he could fit, you know, in different places. Or you can hear those prophets that we've already talked about being echoed in the book of Joel. So I think Joel is using the prophets along with his own inspiration to put this book together. That's how I'm going to say it. But again, that's because I wanted to make a decision, and I think I can argue that position, but I don't think at the end of the argument you're ever going to be able to say what's right and what's wrong, because there's nothing in here. There's just clues. And the same clues that I use for this, you can use the same clues and send it the other way. I mean, there's no slam dunk arguments. There's just how do you interpret this information? I'll interpret it here, and so I'm going to interpret it the other way. So, yeah. Any other thoughts or questions about that? The old commentators and the Jews put him old. And that's kind of why he's at, you know, they would say that's why he's up there right by Hosea. More recent commentators, they've reconsidered the position, and it's kind of like, now we're not talking 10 years, we're talking, you know, the last 80-100 years. It's like, wait, this makes more sense on this side. So I think if you'd go back 200 years, you would be putting, he's right there, Hosea, Joel, and you'd make it work. Where now a scholarship has developed, and I mean positive scholarship. I don't mean liberal scholarship where they don't believe anything. That they've actually examined the book. It's like, wait, this seems to be speaking from this position instead of back there. And so, yeah, the modern commentators are more of a late date, a post-exile. They call it pre-exilic, post-exilic. And I've got it here. I didn't realize I was going to end up pushing it, and others have also. I mean, we're back during the days of Alexander. I mean, if again, that's not for sure. It's just interesting. I mean, because you got to, Ezra is a big deal, because Ezra is kind of like the one who, like Moses wrote the first five books, but like we've talked about, he actually edited Genesis. The toledot of the account of, and he put all this information together, put it in a night under the inspiration. But it's compiled. I don't think Moses went up on a mountain and God says, "Well, write." In the beginning, I mean, Moses had information he was drawing from. In fact, he puts it in there. This is the written document of, and he compiled, took the things out and condensed it. Moses did that in Genesis. That's a very healthy interpretation. Ezra takes everything that had come from the time of David and all the prophets, and he compiles with the scholars, he compiles and puts together, and puts headings in it. This is not what we call higher textual criticism. Higher textual criticism is you go back in and say, well, this wasn't really written by Moses. This wasn't really written by Jeremiah. It was all written back here by the people that they just made everything up. That's higher level criticism. There's no authenticity to it. Textual criticism is you look at it and you realize there's no way Moses could have written, and Moses was the most humble man ever. I mean, as Moses is writing, it's like, what is that? Or the end of the book of Deuteronomy, and Moses died and was buried by the Lord. It's like, well, Moses didn't write that. It's like, well, yeah, he did. Maybe it's like common sense would say someone wrote that for him, and as they're editing the book and closing down the book, they put that in there. And the same thing, there's places where Ezra, for example, I don't have it here on the chart, but 2 Chronicles, oh yeah, right here, 2 Chronicles 36 records 539. Now, 2 Chronicles is about the kings and ends with the destruction of Jerusalem, but then it talks about Jehoiakim going, and then it kind of wraps it up saying, and then they came back from, in 539, the Persians sent them back, and they came back, and it's like, well, that wasn't written by the original writers of Chronicles, because that would have been before the destruction. So clearly there's an edit going on there, and that would be Ezra. That would be what he called textual criticism. It's like, this wasn't written by the originals. They had to come back. Now, higher criticism says, well, they just kept going and changing stuff and updating stuff. Well, if they think these are the Holy Scriptures, they're not going to do that to the Holy Scriptures. They're going to preserve them as accurately as they can. So that's the difference. Understand higher criticism and just basic textual criticism. And so that would mean Ezra's wrapping all these things up and putting things together, but guys like Malachi and Joel will come after and not be edited by him, but someone's going to just stick them in the text of Scripture. Again, we're walking on clouds here. I mean, we're grabbing at things. Does that make sense at all? I mean, any other thoughts? I'll say something else here. So we're going to do Joel. I'm going to put it here, but I want to, I think, to get there is to kind of sweep through this time period in the next few weeks, if that's okay. Is that okay? I mean, and it's going to include, you know, Ezra, and we got to do Haggai and Zechariah, and if we're going to do them in chronological order, we'll have to, like I said, a couple weeks. Okay, now we're staring down a decade there. And then notice how Ezra pops up. Ezra's here. Ezra is here during Darius. Ezra, then we got Esther, and then Ezra's here, and then Ezra's actually living and active. In 458, Ezra leaves Babylon on April 8th. He arrives in Jerusalem on August. He spends 3 months investigating the situation. I mean, I don't know if I like Ezra. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you got to like him. He's a man of God. He's good. But I get the impression that if me and Ezra came head to head, that I would just walk away and move out into the country, because it's like, I don't know if I like his attitude. I mean, he comes in 458. He comes here. Before Nehemiah, and again, I think, I'm not saying he's not a man of God. He's definitely a man of God. I'm just saying I don't know if I would have got along with him. I'd like to think I'd get along with Paul, but I'm not sure if me and Paul would get along. I'm sure I'd get along with Barnabas, because he's just a nice guy. I mean, he just kind of puts up with it. You know, he's one of these guys that gets along with everyone, and so he'd get along with me, and I'd say, me and Barnabas are friends, but it's really just because Barnabas is a great guy, and he's just putting up with me. So, I mean, you kind of look at these people's characters. But nonetheless, I will say, I don't think I would like Ezra. He shows up in 458, details his journey, and then he spends 3 months investigating, just going around asking people questions. Who are you married to? Where is she from? What do you eat? Where do you get your food? How many times a day do you pray? I mean, just going, it's like all this stuff. Where's your scriptures? How many times have you read them? Have you ever read them publicly? It's like, we need to read these things publicly. And then after a three-month investigation, he begins making some changes. And You got right here. Nehemiah shows up to build the walls on August 10th of 445. By October 2nd, they're done. Then October 8th of 445, Ezra calls everybody together, and they, for the first time, they have a public reading of the law. And he reads through it all day long, to read, and people got to stand there and listen. Now, again, I'm all about Bible teaching. I'm all about the Bible, but, I mean, Ezra's the man pulling this off. And the thing is, he's reading it in Hebrew, and guess what? No one can understand it. Because they're all from Persia. They all speak some other language. They speak Aramaic, or they speak something other than, and so then they have to interpret. So he's reading it, and then they're interpreting it. So Ezra is reading from the Hebrew, and then there's an interpreter interpreting it to the people. So all day long you hear him go, wah, 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 wah in Hebrew, and then someone else explains it, reads it, interprets it for them in their language so the people can, and it's the first time they've heard it. The first thing is that that's the first time they've had that. And so he does a great job and kind of cleans things up. This is when they there and back here, when Ezra's recording back here, they wipe out a bunch of the priests because the priests come back and they don't have their paperwork. They lost it in the burning, in the captivity. It's gone. And it's like, well, I'm a priest. I mean, now that's going to cause some problems. And now that's where the Samaritans are going to come from. So a lot of the Samaritans are going to be, especially, and Ezra's going to make it worse. The Samaritans came down. They said, well, we want to help build the temple. And the Jews say, no, you can't help. We got to do it just the Jews. And the Samaritans said, well, we're Jews. No, you're not Jews. Your dad was a Jew, or your grandfather was a Jew, but he married a Gentile that was brought in by the Assyrians. Or he married someone during the Babylonian captivity. And you're a Samaritan. You've lost your claim to being Jewish because your mother was a Gentile or your father was a Gentile. Well, that's not fair. That's not very Christ-like. It's like, well, that's the law, and they wouldn't let him help. And then the Samaritans, we're talking back here. We're talking back here. And, you know, Jesus tells a story about the Good Samaritan. I mean, this is taking place back in the 500s, and 5 centuries later, when Jesus wants to walk through Samaria, he says, I think it's best we go around. They say, you can't walk through our land. And James and John have an answer to the solution. You want us to call fire out of heaven and burn these Samaritans up and we'll just walk right through? And Jesus shakes his head, you don't know what spirit you are, but let's just walk around the Jordan River and go down the other way. So, I mean, this problem here that they're having animosity with continues for 5 centuries. And then when Alexander comes, they don't submit to him, and he destroys them. And the Jews are like, well, we should go help him. No, we shouldn't. We should help supply Alexander if he needs any help. But they want to come down and help build the temple, and they won't let them. And then when Nehemiah comes to build the wall, who doesn't like to see? Well, here, I'll tell you this. When they start building the temple, the Samaritans send delegates to Darius the First, the Great, to tell him, hey, this wicked city is rebuilding, and we just want to let you know we're on your side, and you don't want this to happen. And so Darius goes, stop. And right in here, there's an archive in Babylon is searched for the Cyrus's decree. They said, and the Jews followed up. They sent a delegation of lawyers. They said, no, we got written doc. We got documentation right here. Here's our proof. They go, well, that's your. Where's our copy? So they go and they search in the archives of Babylon for Cyrus's decree that says they can rebuild the city and the temple and the altar, and they find it. And here's, for example, here's some of the archive stuff. And there's right there a cylinder. It mentions the Jews on that, the Cyrus cylinder that's in the British Museum. But they're checking the archive according to the scriptures. They said they checked the archive, and they found, yes, they can build this city. And so they go, ha, 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 and the Jews go back and continue building. But they get burned out. And then when Nehemiah shows up and says, we're going to build the wall, if you remember the story, they say in Nehemiah, he does the same thing. He comes over and goes, does a night march around the city, kind of rides around to check the walls, how bad is the situation, comes back the next day. I mean, he's in 446, he's a wine bearer for Artaxerxes. In 445, he's over there taking charge of Jerusalem. And he's got, and the thing, one reason he can, one, he's skilled, he's trained, but he's also got the emperor's backing. He says, we need to rebuild these walls, and here's how we're going to get it done. And gets it done in a matter of like a month and a half. But while they're building, at night, the Samaritans would come out and knock the wall over that they built. So what they had to do, they had to build with, how'd they say it, spade in one hand and a sword in the other. Because they'd build for a while. Here comes the Samaritans. They'd have to stop and fight the Samaritans off, then go back and build a wall. So the Samaritans are harassing this whole thing here. There's another time, right here, and during the same time, when Xerxes is assassinated. Now, again, I know I'm just throwing information at you, but Xerxes, you know Xerxes from Esther. Xerxes is the one prophesied by Daniel 11, that says a king will come that will stir up the Greeks. And you see it happening in, right here, Esther chapter 1 and 485, Xerxes' first year. He has a big party, brings everybody and all of his generals, and it's basically a pre-war celebration. Here's all of our equipment. Everybody get organized. It's a patriotic. They're playing the national anthem. They've got the military marching. They've got everybody's like, let's conquer Greece. Let's just keep going west. And everybody's like, no one can stop us. No one can. And that's a big party in Esther chapter 1. Well, then in 481 to 479, remember Esther 1. What happens in Esther 1? They're having a big party, and he calls for Vashti. Xerxes. He calls for his wife. Hey, I've got the most beautiful woman in the world. You guys all want to see her? And again, people have different ways of understanding. She says, come out and show everybody your beauty. And she goes, no way. You're a bunch of, now what the reason was, you're a bunch of drunken men. I'm not going to come out. Or she was pregnant with Artaxerxes. And it's like, honey, I ain't what you think. Last time you saw me was like 3 months ago. And some things have taken place. And I'm 3 months pregnant. I'm not coming out. We don't know. Or he wanted her to come out and dance naked. Some people, we don't know. But bottom line, he's getting ready. Xerxes is getting ready to invade Greece. And he goes, come on out, woman. And she says, no. And it's like, and all the guys are like, you're invading Greece and you got a woman saying, no, I think we better stop the military parade and let's rethink this thing because you can't even control the woman. And so he divorces her, however it describes, he puts her away. Now, she may have been pregnant with Artaxerxes. So he's got no queen. Who needs a queen? Men, we're going to war. We don't need the women. That's not scriptural, but whatever he's saying. And he goes to war. Now, if you don't like his attitude, you'll love what takes place. So in between 481 and 479, he goes to make war against the Greeks. And he had the Battle of Thermopylae, Salamis, and Plataea. Three major battles. Now, they're all detailed in history. In fact, the movie 300, anybody see the movie 300? No one saw the movie 300. It's okay. Oh. You kind of got to let your hair down once in a while and see some movies, okay, folks? No. But anyway, that's the battle. It's called 300. That's the Battle of Thermopylae. And anyway, but end of the line, he sets his ivory throne up. He oversees the battle on all these, and he just watches his troops get slaughtered by the Greeks time after time after time. And so in 479, he comes home, and he has been crushed. But he has done what Daniel 9 said. He has stirred up the king of the Greeks, which is going to be Alexander, who's on his way. But he started war, and he got beaten. He came back home, and he never leaves again. It's like he doesn't have – he didn't have a wife. And so he realized that when he gets home, he not only lost the wars, he lost his wife, and he's weak on that border, and the Greeks are starting to come across and make settlements in Turkey, in Persian territory, which is why it encourages Philip to go across, join those, and just keep moving. And then he gets assassinated because there's some say, we don't want a war with the Greeks because they're a big empire. Nonetheless, He, in 479, 478, Esther chapter 2 takes place when he says, I need a queen because I forgot, I lost my head and I don't have a queen anymore. So they said, well, let's find a beautiful woman, and they start bringing in women. I mean, you read that. We'll read it. You decide what's taking place, but it takes her weeks to get ready, perfumed and bathed and hair done and workout, toning, exercise machines, whatever they're doing, to get her fit to see the, you know, probably special training techniques or whatever. That's what the king likes. And she gets to spend some time with the king. I mean, it's as pagan as you can make. It's like, well, I'm sure there wasn't sex involved. I'm sure it was like a coffee and tea, and they probably went out a couple times, maybe caught a movie. It's like, you can Christianize it if you want to, but it's Xerxes. I mean, and he's got a harem. In fact, this header right here, this is a lintel from the harem where Esther would have spent time. This was in the Oriental Institute Museum in Chicago. And this was there. All this is also from Xerxes' time. So they've excavated. They found where the harem was. They've excavated. And this is where Esther would have spent time. And it was her time. She came in and spent the night with the king. Probably just, you know, small talk and things like this. The Qumran community that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, one book they did not find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Esther. Because that's where the men were there. It's like, we don't need this kind of literature here in the Qumran. Now, and the name God is not mentioned in the book of Esther. The word God is not in there. It's like, it's insinuated, but it's not directly in there, which is kind of interesting. But again, Esther takes place right there, and she is a Jew. She saves the people. And it's a typical, like we talked about in Habakkuk, Haman makes a plan to destroy the Jews, but in his Hamas, not in his Hamas, his arrogance, I forgot the word I was going to use, in his arrogance, he ends up dying on his own gallows. He's going to hang, kill all the Jews. Well, he ends up being hung by Xerxes, because Esther marries Xerxes, and I mean, that's a great story, because that's Xerxes, is, and Esther has him wrapped around her little finger. What Vashti couldn't do, Esther seems to pull it off. So Esther now is, I got to admire Esther. Put her in, if you understand this position of Xerxes, and Esther is in there working the system. I mean, she's in control of that situation. And now we don't know. She would have lived into Artaxerxes' time. Xerxes is finally assassinated in 464, probably because of he's a loser. I mean, he's proven a loser in the Greek. And Artaxerxes takes his place, and that's where Artaxerxes now. Esther would still be alive. Esther would have been the queen mother when Nehemiah is serving the son, Artaxerxes, his wine. So Nehemiah would have known Esther from the palace, potentially. You understand what I'm saying? So that's all taking place right there. And that's when Nehemiah comes over, builds the wall. And then Malachi closes down the Old Testament. And it talks about, again, talks about the day of the Lord, before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So now, here's Joel. Day of the Lord is a big thing in his book. So somehow Joel's going to fit into this situation right there. Does that help at all? I mean that's one of those, for a lot of people, you know, for myself for a long time, that's kind of like with that dead zone in the Bible. I mean, you know Genesis, you know the Exodus, you know a little bit about the David. Then you got to manage your way through Israel in the north and Judah. And then you got the exile, Jeremiah, a lot of activity there. But then all of a sudden now you're into here. And what is all these? In fact, some of these books are out. I mean, you got Nehemiah and Esther before the book of Psalms. It's like, what is going on? And then you got Ezra. Where does Ezra take place? Well, Ezra has the information here, and he doesn't show up into Jerusalem until here. And this is when he's alive and living, but he's got information collected. And then Nehemiah, he doesn't stay. He goes back. These guys aren't free. They work for the Persians. Okay, what we're going to need to do, if I'm going to do this, what I think is right, we left off right here. We left off in 580, you know, with Jeremiah. We do have Obadiah, okay? I'm sorry. We've got the book of Obadiah. To do this right, the next book is Obadiah, and that is where we'll go next week. We'll see how long that takes. It's one chapter. It's probably just 20 minutes. But Obadiah is going to introduce, just like Nahum was a prophet against Nineveh, Obadiah is a prophet against Edom. Because when 586 was taking place and Babylon was destroying Jerusalem, the Edomites, Edom, they're descendants of Esau, they thought, aha, Babylon's going to destroy Judah, and they'll get busy in other areas, and we'll just kind of push our northern border up into Judean territory. And this is a good thing, they thought. And in fact, apparently, they're even helping them. And the Jews are trying to, running and hiding. I mean, their city's burning. They're running and hiding and going down to Edom. And the Edomites are like, well, hey, sure, you can hide here. And then they go up and say, over here. And they'd bring the Babylonians in, and the Jews would get slaughtered. And Obadiah says, that's not the way you treat your brother, Esau and Jacob. And so Obadiah is a book against the Edomites. And after this book right here, they basically, you know, they're going to be overrun by Babylon too, and they're going to end up disappearing from history. And that's where you get that phrase, Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. And it comes out of Malachi right here. Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. What's that mean? Jacob is destroyed by the Babylonians, but I've loved, and that word love is a covenant, hasid. It means covenant love. I mean, it's so stupid. It's so stupid. It's so shallow. God's got an emotional connection with Jacob. Esau, not so much. No, the word is hasid. It's covenant love. It's marriage love. Now, I love Tony. I'm attracted to Tony. I'm in love with Tony, but I am hasid with Tony, which means I have a covenant relationship with Tony. If I like her, if I don't like her, I have a covenant love for Tony. I'm committed to Tony. Now, other women, I hate them. Well, you hate them? Well, yeah, I don't have a covenant with them. I mean, Tony, I've got to, she's mine. I'm responsible. She's responsible. We're in a covenant. So Tony, I've loved. All the other women, no covenant. I have not loved them. What's, are you talking sexual? I'm not talking if I like them, if they look good. It means I am not in a covenant relationship with any other woman. Jacob, I've loved. Hasid, I have a covenant. Esau, I haven't. They have no covenant. So when Esau's overrun and destroyed, they're gone. You had your time in the sun as a pagan nation. You lived it out and you're done. Jacob, on the other hand, I have loved. I have a covenant. I promised Abraham I would give him a nation, and I'm going to come back and get him. I mean, that's what that means. It has nothing to do with emotion. It has nothing to do with salvation. Jacob, I've loved. I've got a covenant. That doesn't mean they're all going to heaven. I mean, not all the Jews are going to heaven. It can't mean that. Because many Jews, Jesus taught, that are perishing. They have a covenant that got, as a nation, but not for salvation, as a nation. And salvation will come to the nations through Israel, but they've got to accept the message of salvation. I mean, it really makes sense, I think. Now, if other people say, well, that's not right. John Calvin wouldn't agree with me. Neither would Ezra, probably. But I don't know. I'd hope Ezra would agree with me, or at least I'd be close. All right, we're going to pick up Obadiah, and then we're going to somehow manage to go through this chart and read these scriptures of what's taking place historically. And then as we bump into Haggai and Zechariah, this will be, I mean, that's amazing. You've got two books from 1 year, plus you got a couple chapters from Ezra in the year 520. I mean, that's a lot of information for 520. So the years that are important, 539, they come back. 520, the prophets arise, say, oh, hey, they build the altar in 536. Nothing takes place until 520, where they're all kind of chewed out. 516, they finish the temple. And so the temple is in place in 516. And then we've got people taking place, Nehemiah, Ezra, Esther, and Malachi. All right, I'll pray and we're done. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for revealing your plan of salvation and keeping track of history for us, that we may follow your work in history. We ask that we may find information useful for us from the scriptures and from history, that we might live a life at this time that is pleasing to you. Again, we thank you for this opportunity. In Jesus' name, amen.